Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, and our special guest, Denise DeCook. A little later, Jace Bolger, former Speaker of the House, will be joining us, talk a little bit about his experience in redistricting. But first, Denise, I thought we could talk about that to kick things off. You are a veteran of the process of electing Republicans to the state Senate. And just thinking for a moment, what if the Court of Appeals decision on new elections for 2020 stands, and we actually have to have state Senate elections during a presidential for, I think, the first time since the 60s. I went back in the archives and looked, and it was before our current Constitution.
Correct. I think what's going to be interesting about this is, let me start with, I think the prognosis for that actually occurring is someplace between 0 and 5%. Just given how the court is and how slow and deliberative, they have to agree to take up the case. So I'm not convinced it's going to happen. But to your question, I really in some ways think the last election cycle is a little instructive. We had this huge turnout in 18, was between what a traditional gubernatorial is and a presidential. So if it were to come to pass where there were Senate elections in this presidential year, I think that there are some perhaps partisans on the other side who see it as a distinct political advantage. But I would also say I think that the partisans on my side of the aisle are probably more prepared because of what happened in 18 than they might ordinarily be. I do think it will impact suburbia differently.
How so?
I think what you have in Michigan is you have the inner urban centers, then you have suburbia, and then you have outstate Michigan rural territory. And it's that suburban ring that in the last gubernatorial saw a big boost more from what I would call Democrats or leaning Democrats or independents who in the past had identified as Republicans, today identify more as lean Dem. So they turned out. But what will happen in a presidential is those same suburban voters who only turn out and are Republicans, they're going to turn out where they may not have in this last cycle. But so I think the presidential issue hits both ways. I think it will be more challenging. I think it will draw resources. But I also think don't count it out because there is this kind of tipping point that takes place. If there is going to be a huge turnout, there's at some point equally as many Republicans that turn out as Democrats. Because in this presidential year, there is going to be a fight for over ideology. Like Trump or dislike Trump, there are folks, even in blue-collar territory, who they would rather see a Trump, and they may turn out and vote for others down the ticket who have that same belief. So I wouldn't say count your chickens before they hatch.
I thought Republicans turned out regardless. They would turn out in gubernatorial elections. They would turn out in presidential elections, and it was the Democrats who were less likely to vote in a gubernatorial. But I guess we saw in 18 that they were motivated to vote this last time.
They were motivated, and I think really the biggest group that turns out in presidential years presently is the young voter. Hmm. That is why Obama racked up huge numbers, because he was able to get to that 20-somethings who are kind of occasional voters. They're more worried about the date, what's on their iPhone, and where they're going to be spending time at the bar, and what their job is going to be, and how they're going to pay off student loans. They are not thinking about politics. They don't have investments. So they think differently. Obama was able to turn those people out. Presidential years, that's where you see the surge. So you look at areas like Michigan State, East Lansing. You look at Ann Arbor. You look at Mount Pleasant. All of those territories, they're going to see a surge, but Republicans in the House districts have been winning in a lot of those areas. I was thinking more specifically about Central and Mount Pleasant. Hmm. So I think it's going to be a good old-fashioned fisticuffs. And don't prejudge the voter. That is the worst thing any operative can do. I love being sort of the channeler of the voter and trying to figure out where are they at now? What's important to them now? In the old days, it was one or two things. Now it's a menu of items, up to 16, 18 items that they care about. And how do you communicate? And these devices make it so much easier to communicate on individual issues.
Says Denise, pointing to her smartphone.
This question kind of gets to that whole point. Do you think that, let's assume that Mr. Trump gets another term. Post-Trump, is there going to be a huge letdown in terms of participation? It seems like, it feels like sometimes we have so much energy invested in this national political position right now, whether you're a Dem or an R,
right,
that we're all going to be exhausted whenever he leaves office. And we're going to be like, screw this. I'm done with this for like at least another election cycle.
Is there going to be a letdown?
There could well be. And honestly, if you look at it historically, that has occurred in many races. Hmm. You have this huge boon of increased interest, and then it's almost cathartic. It's values. It's those values that are coming forth in candidates, in presidential candidates, and a redefinition. I believe that what happened when Trump was elected is this was a shout out to every standing politician, Republican or Democrat. Pay attention to me because you haven't been. And that's what I think this 8 years is about. Well, 4 years now, potentially eight. And then do I think there'll be fatigue? Yes, because at some point the voter pool is going to change. 8 years is a long time. And there's going to be folks who are either going to be disadvantaged or advantaged, and they're going to carve out their particular territory. Right now we're talking about a host of different issues that have atrophied over the years. And that's where I see this presidential, the last presidential election being defining. And this one as well. How much are we going to continue it? Or where's the stopgap where we want to challenge on certain points?
The thing that I noticed in 2018 was all this turnout talk and everything. And it was known from the beginning it was going to be closer to a presidential turnout than usual.
Yes.
But the part that surprised me was the Slotkin race. 17 million to 10 million outspending Bishop. The 11th district, I think that was 10 million to 4 million. Can the Democrats outspend the Republicans in places like that again and have the Republicans have any chance?
That is a really good question, because I would hazard a guess that yes, they're going to have the resources to defend. That's a critical issue. Once you get something, you will spend whatever it takes to keep it, especially in Congress. So do I think there'll be outside forces that'll come in to make sure that a Slotkin can compete? Yes, but this is gonna be a different race in both those seats. They are now gonna have a record to defend. And that's gonna cost
if
more
you've
money.
Watched, if you've watched and listened to Slotkin, she sounds like a pretty good Republican so far. She's obviously very serious about representing that district, but what is it with the Dems? They seem to have a handful of billionaires who have sort of divvied up, you take this state, you take this state, and it's going to be pretty interesting to watch where that money goes.
I don't disagree with you. And I think where they're going to have to, I don't know them, they don't call me, I'm not on their speed dial. However, I'm guessing they're smart people, and they're going to look at the 50 states and look at what redistricting coming up, and where do we have to have a foothold? So if the Slotkin seat is a seat that they believe is worthy of investment, not just for this cycle, but for the next 10 years, that's a generational issue. Knowing what investors are, they are not fly-by-nights, not on the Republican side or the Democrat side. They look at long-range return on investment.
So with that in mind, with the money coming in for Democratic candidates, you mentioned the higher turnout for the youth vote. That would seem like the Democrats, who are now at 23-15 minority in the Senate, it seems like they would have maybe the best opportunity in a long time to get majority if we have elections in 2020. Yes?
If we have elections in 2020, they can have a shot. But they also thought they had a shot in 18.
But you know, like I mean, they have a shot here.
Well, I'm not sure that's true.
More voters, more money?
If it was only about money and vote and those individual voters, that's one thing. But it's, you know what happens? It's a race about who is running. It's about the two individuals who are running and what their bandwidth is in a community. We just talked about Slotkin. Slotkin has developed a very strong constituent program. She is every place. Now, so that may be true, but that you're divorcing yourself from who are the players who are going to really put themselves out there for the voters to make a choice. And Michigan is a lot of things. It is not a straight party state. And I believe it's partly because we're a peninsula state. We are kind of independent in that way. We have our own way of doing things. Michigan is one of only two states that has jurisdiction political divisions that are based upon cities and townships. That's why we have over 1,600 election officials. The only other state in the country that has that is New Hampshire. Every place else does it based on county. So we have, in the spirit of what this state is, a strong sense of independence and self-determination. And so I get back to those candidates who are on the ballot. They're the ultimate deciders on the campaigns that are run. It may make it easier sledding or more difficult sledding. But money does tend to be one of the items that is an equalizing factor. And if the Dems go to Congress, how much is there going to be? I think it's impressive that the Senate Republicans have just actually retired their debt by May 1st from the last election cycle.
And the Senate Dems have not.
Correct.
Now, looking back at the 90s, at Macomb County, it was impossible to look at their voting record there and not realize that people were voting for Engler and Dave Bonnier on the same on the same ballot.
And we have had that all along. That gets back to my previous point on messaging. What motivates a voter today? In the old days, it was you're a fiscal conservative, you're a social conservative. You could put people in like 4, 5, 6 boxes. Today, the motivating factors are so different. Just look at the complexities that we're dealt with on information every day. It is so exponentially bigger than what it was 20 years ago. Why would we not think that the voters have exponentially different issues that they care about? It would seem to me to be naive to not assume they have a variety of interests, and Michigan also has an underlying issue of the independents.
So let's move over to more of the presidential angle now here. We've got, 21 candidates now who have announced on the Democratic side. So the question I have for you, Denise, is when do we stop this slope up and we start the slope down? When we had the Republicans, we had in 2016, 13 candidates, I think was the peak, and then people started dropping off. When are people going to start dropping off on the Democratic side?
I'm going to get to the answer this in a little bit of a roundabout way. I thought that the last presidential election was like, can there be another Republican candidate who gets in? I mean, how do you get all these people on the stage? And we were at, 12, 14?
Yeah.
And now it's like 20 plus, and I think there's going to be more on the Democratic side.
Right.
Now, I'm not a Democrat consultant. I don't know, but it does strike me what I know about how elections move is there are people who have an appetite to challenge Trump on a host of different issues. They may think they're worthy of it. And there's a little bit of a tipping point. Is it 12 candidates that are legitimate, sincere, want to be president? Or at what point after that 12 or 14, is it just people wanting to expand their political footprint for their future? I think that's another tipping point. Because right now, after you get to 12 or 15, it's going to be what happens in Iowa, what happens in New Hampshire, what happens in the early races. And if you are one of those outliers and you just get in and say, hey, I'm just going to focus on Iowa, I'm going to focus on New Hampshire, and if I can get in the top cut, wow, I have now made a nationwide political presence for myself. Nobody counted me there, but I'm in.
God, could you just imagine what the folks in Iowa are going through right now,
though?
I mean, all these people visiting every coffee shop and the TV and the mailers, and goodness gracious.
But speaking as a Republican, I have to say this. It warms my heart to see so many people so far to the left. Other than Biden getting in, there is not anyone who is talking to the middle, and that forces some of those middle people to really say, okay, kind of like you, Democrat X, but you're just a little too lib for me. I can't afford you. I can't afford you as my president. Ideologically, I may not like my president in totality, but I can afford him.
I was thinking about that when I think it was Beto came out with his global climate change. I can't remember a presidential candidate espousing a trillion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar program before. While running for office, do you?
I cannot either. And honestly, it felt like a couple of these that have come out, abolish insurance. There's all of these kind of brainy.
Or what about this Yang guy who wants to give $1,000 to everybody?
I think there's going to be this value that says, okay, well, that's nice to talk about at the dinner table, but let's get real. So there is a practical side to this. Speaking again as a Republican, I'm tickled that the more the liberal candidates get in, the more the discussion is on that side, and that with each one, Trump's reelection enhances.
I wonder, with the extra voters that Trump brought in, the kind of crossing over to some blue-collar Dems, et cetera, the famous Macomb County Dems. Are the other Republicans who are running down ticket, are they nimble enough to cross over and start picking up any of those people, or are they just going to stick to the traditional stuff?
So I think it comes down, if you saw what happened in 16, they were very nimble because some of these are heart and soul issues. I worked in Muskegon County. I've worked there for years. And Muskegon County has a group of individuals over there who, while they are probably more progressive on the spectrum, they are very founded in let me keep my guns, I'm pro-life, I am all of these things, and there's a lot of blue-collar over there. People who are fighting to keep their homes, they've seen some tough times. So there are pockets out there that are much like Macomb, and they're going to vote their pocketbook, and they feel like they have been let down by the Democratic Party over the years.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying is the thing that is the same everywhere is know your district.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Again, the person who disrespects the voter, they do it at their own peril.
The time that we're going to start seeing people drop out, it doesn't sound like it's going to be anytime soon. Would you say the fall next year? When are we going to start seeing the real drop off?
I think it's not going to happen until you may see some drop in the fall out of money. They just can't generate the financial support to keep moving in the early states. But my gut is it's the weeding out process is going to be probably the first part of the year. After we start to see the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire, these races and these primaries and caucuses happen for a reason. The early states in many ways determine who are the front runners. And I don't see that changing despite how large the field is.
All right, last thing we wanted to touch on with you, Denise, before we let you go. Now, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but has it seemed to you that things have gotten a little off to a slow start here in the state legislature?
You know, the last election that we had, we saw more changes in who sits in the seats in the governor's office, the House, and the Senate. And so, yes, I do think it's been a little slower because people are getting their sea legs. They are trying to figure out how do we work together? What is my job? Even individuals who served in the House and who've now moved to the Senate is has a different rhythm. Mm-hmm. It has a schedule. You have to vote in 60 seconds. That is very different from the rough and tumble of the House. And in the Senate, it has been, in all the years I've done it, for 40 years, the chairmen are much more empowered to make decisions. And so even if you have experience from the House, you're now a committee chair. And you're trying to figure out, okay, how do I do this? I haven't had this kind of power before. I report to Mike Shirky, but he's giving me the ability to craft the agenda. That takes time. And so I do think that is true. Conversely, the governor, she had to get people in place. That takes time. And then once you get individuals in place, do you want them to act expeditiously or do you want them to act wisely? And I do think she has been smart in figuring out what her priorities are and very thoughtful in how she engages and develops relationships with the House and the Senate.
So you think Governor Whitmer's done pretty good then in her first...
She has done a pretty good job because she comes from the legislature. She understands there's a living, breathing side of this, that it's not just about the leaders. It's about all of their constituencies, and she has her constituency. It is, I would say, very, very different than the early days of the Granholm administration. That was much more contentious. It was much more out of the gate. It was very personal, too. It was very personal. And I think everyone, from what I understand, they all are very honest about what their objectives are. And there's some thorny issues there. The roads, obviously, huge issue for the governor. We haven't seen any action on that. Reminds me of the public as a little bit like pitchforks and torches. Yes, we want our potholes fixed, especially this time of year. But boy, they're very reluctant to go into their pocketbook and pay for it.
Denise DeCook from DeCook Strategies, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I want to get into it, man, you know. Not now, Chase. We're busy. Not now, Chase.
All right, joining us now in MERS World Headquarters is former Speaker of the House, Jace Bolger. Thanks for making the drive over here. We appreciate it.
That's my pleasure to be here. I was in town already, so it's nice to stop by.
The reason we wanted to have you in was because you were the Speaker of the House back during the last redistricting process in 2011 and were responsible for the maps that the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals recently declared were partisan gerrymandered. And we wanted to get your thoughts on that and also maybe talk a little later about the process involved in doing districts. But let's first get your reaction to the decision from the court.
Unfortunately, I think it's a political decision to a political complaint, and that's the very nature of this, is this is a political conversation. And when I say political, I don't necessarily mean partisan. I just mean it's part of a political process. And so there was a political complaint filed about them. It was all about partisanship. And then the court weighed in, and I think, in a political, making a political decision, which is not what I think we want our courts to do. And that can lead into, well, then what next? We know that there's cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think that's exactly what they're going to struggle with, is do we want the courts making these decisions? Ironically, in Michigan, that's exactly what used to happen, where the maps would be drawn by the courts. And the courts made changes, the APOL standards, so that the courts didn't have to draw the maps anymore. The judiciary, a separate branch of government, shouldn't be in the position of drawing maps for the legislative branch.
Now, you were careful to say political and not partisan. We did have the that circuit court bench had two Democratic presidential appointees on it, but you're not using the partisan word here.
So I'm going, no, I don't. I don't want to see our courts that way. And that's the danger. And so when I say political, it's very much to the question at hand before the U.S. Supreme Court, is you've got Maryland and you've got Republicans there upset about what the Democrats had done. You've got North Carolina where you've got Democrats upset about what the Republicans had done. And ultimately, then you have the courts in the position of making a political decision. And so I don't think the courts should be involved in that political decision. I can't believe our U.S. Supreme Court wants to be involved in making that decision, because if there should be absolutely a raft of reasons that you could sue on maps. For example, diluting minority representation would be a valid reason to sue. But if it's about the political squabble between two parties, you can guarantee the federal courts will be drawing every map from here on out, because there'll always be a dispute.
You were kind of central to the last process. Talk about how much time you actually spent protecting, say, Congressman X or Senator Z, or was it all seeking your party's advantage? What else went into the discussions, and kind of what's the average of what you spent your time on when you were in the midst of that?
We focused on the APOL standards. So that is that you have to have equal representation, you have to have contiguous districts, you have to minimize the time that you break existing communities or real communities or defined communities within our state, and you have to preserve minority representation. That's where we spend our time. And to that, you get that question quite a bit, is this all about protecting incumbents? And I can point to multiple examples that demonstrate that is not what it's about. For example, at the time, State Representative Rick Olson, the demographics had changed. So people had moved around in Washtenaw County. And there was a map that I remember sharing with him. And he said, so you're saying my time is done. There's no way he was going to be able to win in the new district. It was what it was. We drew the maps based on how population had shifted. We had Lisa Postumus Lyons and Ken Yonker, because of population shifts there, they were put into the same district. If they wanted to both continue to serve, one of them had to move. Ken Yonker ended up moving. Same with Andrea LaFontaine in Macomb County. She had to move to decide. So it was not about protecting those incumbents. And when I mentioned political conversation or political decisions, there was, I do remember now, somebody had to remind me that in Detroit, there was proposals, reactions coming out of Detroit. The governor made me go back repeatedly and talk to the Detroit delegation. Ironically, the Detroit delegation was pushing a proposal that would have protected more incumbents, but would have split Mexicantown, would have diluted Hispanic representation. And so it was not legal. And so we stuck to those APOL standards, which, again, you go back to the history in the state Supreme Court, and those criteria came about to seek to avoid this continual deadlocking and the courts having to draw the maps.
But you take a look at, once you get past the APOL standards, though, my understanding is, and this is from our last guest last week, Mark Grebner, he said that there are now mathematical formulas that people have developed where if you put all these APOL standards and the civil rights factors that you have to consider into a computer and kick out all the different types of maps you can get. This map, the one that you guys approved, was more partisan for the Republicans than your basic map. So partisanship had to have some kind of play into it at some point, yes?
Did he argue that that existed back in 2011? Because I don't remember anything like that. Now, did people make their own calculation? Did I get irritated congressmen calling me because they didn't like the makeup of their map? Yeah, but people calculated that, and ironically, no matter what, how somebody calculated a base for a district, mm-hmm. somebody else had a different number. Somebody else had a different claim about a district. And so I saw a lot of the things that got a lot of attention, Thad McCotter's chief of staff, Thad McCotter's staff and what he said about packing people together.
Yeah.
I didn't even recognize the guy's name when I saw that in the newspaper. He played no role in redistricting, but it's a juicy political claim that that's somehow what was going on. That does not represent what was going on in drawing the maps.
Now, there was other people who had made comments during this process that were used in the court filing. I seem to remember Jeff Timmer had some comments. There were some other comments by consultants about putting all the Republican or the Democratic trash into certain...
That's the comment I'm talking about.
But there were other people.
To that as though it's some sort of evidence of what was going on. And I'm saying I didn't even recognize the guy's name. And so he didn't play a role. Were people seeing maps and trying to do their own calculation about what the politics was? Were there calculations done? Sure, but that's not what drove the maps. That's after they were drafted.
How much did you guys rely on, though, these outside groups like the Michigan Chamber, Bob LeBrant's an expert in redistricting, the other groups? How much did the caucus rely on outside expertise? How much of it was your team members?
So this is where, as Speaker of the House, I was dealing with it. Basically, once it got to the floor, there were a couple of cases like that Rick Olson where I came in for his proposed map. But most of that was done by Pete Lund and his crew and the staff that we hired here. And they did hire experts who had dealt with this issue before. Remember, in 2011, we had just won the majority. So we were getting our feet under us on governing by all fronts. We redid the tax code, we had the deficit that we had to eliminate, and we had to adopt redistricting, among other changes. So if we look at, I've got several maps laid out, and if your listeners went online and looked at the Michigan maps from the 70s, the Michigan maps from the 80s, as well as the Arizona map and the California map. So let's just take a number and look at the first congressional district. You look at the first, so it's the UP in Michigan. It's at the top of the mitten. If you look at the first congressional map in California, it's got all sorts of jagged lines. If you look at the first congressional map in Arizona, it does a big loop around with a couple of hoops up. These were all drawn under different scenarios, and California and Arizona were drawn by independent commissions. And look at the first congressional district in the map that's disputed today. And I will argue to you that the first congressional district makes more sense in the map that the court just ordered we have to redraw than any of these other cases.
And it's because we got a nice straight line here across northern Michigan.
Take your two hands, and the UP is one hand, and the lower peninsula is the other. And the way the first congressional district looks like today is you include all of the upper peninsula, and you draw virtually a straight line across the top of the lower peninsula. And each of these other examples have much more jagged lines and run in other places. So it's more compact and makes more sense. And yet that's an exact district that the court said not it's going to be impacted by other redrawing. The court said that you got to redraw that district. I would say also, when I go back to a political, they didn't touch any of the maps in the city of Detroit, but they're going to the UP here. And that I wonder, how did they make that decision? Why did they draw those lines?
Now, you had mentioned that during 2011, while you guys were going through this redistricting process, there were a lot of other things on the plate. Fast forward to today, 2019, the court has ordered that we have to redraw maps in the next 3 months, and we've got a lot of things on our plate as well, road funding and no-fault insurance. Can it all get done?
It certainly doesn't simplify things, does it? I do go back to the beginning of 2011 and, again, redoing the entire tax code. I remember being scoffed at the time that there's no way that the budget could be done by the end of June or beginning of June, as it were. Redistricting was done shortly thereafter, again, signed into law in August, and I'm sure I'm forgetting many other reforms that were done at that time. It's not easy, but it can be done. It certainly complicates things when you've got these. Again, it's a political decision that's got to be made. Our U.S. Constitution gave it to state legislatures for a reason, and that's because it's a decision about the political makeup, the political drawing of those maps, the political self-governance. And so it doesn't make it any easier. It adds a lot of complexity to the relationships in the legislature. Having this thrown in and the whole dynamic of the state Senate and what that means to them, it's certainly going to complicate their lives.
Last week, Mr. Grebner suggested there's only a 5% chance that this is actually going to occur. What odds would you give it?
Well, I can't agree with Mr. Grebner just out of principle, and so I'll say it's a 95% chance they don't get redrawn. No, I did take the chance to listen. I thought he was spot on several fronts, so I have a little fun at that. But I thought he was spot on, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. And the courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, although if you predict what a court is going to do, you're on a fool's errand. But I think the courts are likely to say, we don't want to be involved in the political decision. There's rational reasons. There are other legal reasons to challenge a map. But if it's about politics, then that ought to be made by the political body, not the judiciary. I would go back to, if we can, a quick conversation about what is gerrymandering and what's appropriate. Many people say that as evidence somehow, whether it's a mathematical calculation or the results of the elections, and that those maps were drawn, back to your point earlier, John, to either protect incumbents or to maintain a party's power. But you look at the results of what happened. So the state house districts. And when Snyder won in 2014, Senator Gary Peters won also in 2014. Who do you think won in those state house districts for those two gentlemen within those maps? So the current state house districts.
The Republicans won.
No. Rick Snyder won 64% of the current state house seats, and Gary Peters won 66% of the current state house seats.
I believe that.
And if you go to Debbie Stabenow in 2012, what percent of the house seats do you think she won?
In 2012. 70% of them.
80%.
Ooh, I was close.
So a Democrat has won in 80% of the current House districts. And yet they've gone to federal court to claim these maps were drawn to make it impossible for a Democrat to win. The voters made decisions. The voters made decisions in those districts to vote for Debbie Stabenow for U.S. Senate and their local Republican for State House.
Completely different subject here, but just a couple more minutes. What do you think of Gretchen Whitmer? How do you think she's been doing so far?
Yeah, her outreach has been remarkable. Her campaign, I think you have to give her a ton of credit for. Very disciplined. She had a vision in her campaign. She was going to go out, and she marched down the field with that vision. I think it's early to judge her governing. I think, again, that outreach, I, as a private citizen, have enjoyed seeing the legislators and the governor say that they want to work together. The proof is about to be in the pudding. Can they get auto insurance done? Can they get a budget done? Can they fix or find a roads solution? So it's easy to talk. It's harder to actually deliver governance. So I'll reserve judgment on performance, but I have to give her credit where that credit's due.
All right, Jace Bolger, former Speaker of the House. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be with you.
That's going to do it for the MERS Monday podcast this week. Thanks to Denise for coming by, Jace Bolger for coming in, Jack and John. And, you know, it's the first real, I think, week of spring. John, I'm so excited because I heard the lawnmower at 9:30 today as opposed to 10:30. Did you make that happen? Do I have you to thank for that?
No, it's not my doing. I've asked them before, so maybe they're finally rearranged their schedule this year.
Or we've just run out of grass, and there's really nothing else to mow out there is what I think it could be.
It needed it, though. It was looking like a wheat field out there before they came this morning.
Hey, did you notice also on the corner here of Ottawa and Butler, there's actually trucks and construction and something that's actually going to happen?
Something's going to happen. They look like they're putting up stakes this morning, and they've got a trailer up there. And
And I find this very newsworthy almost, because I think one of the first things that I did when I started at MERS in 2001 was cover a press conference on that vacant piece of land. And there was a developer, and he was going to develop a store, and, you know, with apartments on top. And you remember this,
yes,
Denise?
I remember
15, almost 20 years ago. And
yep, at one point, that was rumored to be the possible site of a new governor's residence. Mm-hmm. I remember that. That never went anywhere. So,
and it's just been great green grass at a corner lot.
So we're not going to be getting rid of green space, are we?
Well, I don't know. It could be. I mean, it's a beautiful dandelion field right now, but I saw cars parking over there. So
somehow, when I thought, when you first said trucks, I thought maybe somebody was going to fix Butler.
Oh, now that would be amazing.
I'm actually, when I saw that trailer, that was my first thought. Maybe somebody will finally get a word in, and somebody will fix this Butler Street, which has been horrid all the 20 years we've owned this building.
If they don't fix that, the city should make some money by renting it out to tire companies so they can test out their,
They ought to just pull out the asphalt and turn it back to gravel. It'd be smoother.
It would be. Yeah, that's, I mean, we know everybody, you know, and the whole, all our listeners probably feel them actually have to take Butler, but you kind of have to when you're working at MERS.
Now that they've fixed Pine and Walnut, and thank you, Andy Shore, for doing that, now I think that this little stretch of Butler is the worst stretch of road in Lansing.
Well, I think so, by far.
That's our little tip. Now, I'm sure there's other people who've got other bad roads, but this is our bad road. All right, I'm going to go ahead and press stop on this. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullin. Take care.